This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today's program features a forum on the future of the European Union. Panelists delve into the historical unification of Europe and why one country, the United Kingdom, is in the process of leaving. Brexit, or the British exit from the EU, has defined the premiership of now former Prime Minister Theresa May, who for 3 years tried and failed to work out and pass a trade deal between EU officials and the UK Parliament. May's successor in the Conservative Party, Prime Minister Boris Johnson, took office on July 24th, and in his first speech stated that the UK would leave the EU with or without a trade deal on October 31st, 2019. Economists have said that leaving without an agreement, or a so-called hard Brexit, could have immediate and long-lasting impacts on the United Kingdom's economy and the European Union's single market. But what will these impacts look like for the EU and the UK? Has the European Union project been a success for all its member states? These questions and more are addressed on today's wide-ranging panel discussion. Speaking on the panel are professors from the University of Utah's Political Science Department, Assistant Professor Tobias Hoffman, Associate Professor Marjorie Castle, Research Professor John Francis, and Professor Brent Steele. This forum was recorded on November 19, 2018, and originally aired late last year. Speaking first is Research Professor John Francis.
All right, I'm going to do exactly as the moderator instructed and say a few and give a brief account of the origins of the EU, some of its principal themes. Then I'll talk about the challenge presented by the United Kingdom and its desire, or at least the desire of some people in the United Kingdom, to leave the European Union and how that's going. So the founding of the European Union really begins in the decades, in the first two decades following the end of the Second World War, a time of devastation and rebuilding in Europe, and a time to kind of for people to reconsider the dream of European unification that had not really been ever seriously addressed except in times of war. And so there are three basic themes that are woven into the founding of the European Union. First, these three that I've identified captured a good deal of support and won the day. The first is the integration of European economies that would reduce the capability of European nations to go to war. There was a lot of thought that if you could take the major sources, whether it be steel production or coal, and put them under a broader international context or European context, then countries could not gather the what was needed to go to war against one another. The second was the value of a free trade area that would allow Europe to sustain the growth that was beginning in the 50s, to sustain growth, in fact, expand it by having a broad free trade zone. And this was an important theme and one that remains critical to this day. And the third area was that as the Europeans looked out the windows, they noticed that power had left Europe. It had either moved to the United States or it had moved to Russia, or the Soviet Union as it then was. So the idea was that if Europe could integrate, at least to some extent, they could perhaps restore or regain a global voice. So those three themes all played a role during that time. In the 1950s, six countries formed the EU, essentially the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, France, Germany, or West Germany at that time, and Italy. And then it grew, steadily expanding, adding more countries to it. So by today, 28 countries with a combined population of 500 million. It is a remarkably large block of countries that share a good deal in common, except a good deal of legislation that governs their lives that is made by European officials and European representatives. There is essentially, if I were to identify the driving considerations for the European Union today that grew out of the 1950s enterprise, one would look at the following. That is a principle of increasing integration in areas of the free movement of people, goods, services, and capital. So essentially, a Europe without borders for both material and non-material well-being. What is the goal? And a lot of what's been achieved or thought to have been achieved was to reduce barriers to make that work. And over the course of from the 50s to the present, I think it's fair to characterize Europe in the following way. Bouts of no movement at all, it just kind of stayed stuck as it did the first 10 years, and then periods of great energy that resulted in new waves of integration. So either holding firm or expanding integration over the years. What was never really considered was retreating backwards, that is, not having further courses of integration, which is why the Brexit threat is seen as a serious question in this way. Does it mean it could go backwards? Now, the way, if I were to kind of briefly describe the institutions that matter, the governance of Europe is complex. But frankly, if you're a European and you're looking at the United States, the governance of the United States is complex. So you shouldn't make too much out of that theme. But surely some of the actors that have driven the course of integration have been the European Court of Justice. In recent times, the European Council, which is the heads of government of the member states, the senior civil servants that are the European Commission, and the directly elected parliament. And they, among others, play that role. If I were to mention some of the key successes that play a role in current discussions, is that you're a citizen of a member country, then you are also a European citizen, hence another complexity for Brexit. All countries accept the Charter of Human Rights to be woven into their fundamental legislation. All countries are to be functioning democracies, another key point. And 19 member countries share a common currency, but not a common fiscal policy, which has proved to be complicated. Now, I'm going to mention then in return three problems that face Europe at the moment. One is that free movement has come to mean for some political parties in many member states that migrants or refugees seeking a better life who come, say, from the Middle East or North Africa are moving into Europe or at least have in the past. Now it's increasingly hard to do. And they see that as a threat, these nationalist parties, as a threat to their budgets. They'll have to look after the people, so they believe, and to their respective cultures. So the threat of migration is a big issue. Secondly, economic inequality. There's the inequality of the countries of Eastern Europe, some of them, not all of them, who simply don't enjoy quite the same per capita income as people in the West. And then there is the growth in wealth of Northern European states, whereas the Southern European states, Italy at the moment, remain stagnant. So you have problems of inequality and this, or perceived inequality, and this has become an issue. And third, that will be addressed in this panel, is that Eastern Europeans are challenging, in some countries, human rights protection. That is a guarantee of the European Union. Now I'm going to shift. Why Brexit? Why is one country thinking about leaving? And I'm going to give you my interpretation of why that is. A referendum was held on whether the United Kingdom should leave the EU. This was only done because the then Prime Minister thought that if a referendum were held, people would want to stay and his party would resolve an internal division. That is the Conservative Party. To his surprise, it didn't quite pan out. But it was a very close election. And this also was a good rule that you should never have referenda to solve constitutional issues. Let that be a warning to all. So you have that as an issue. And frankly, most people voting didn't have a real good grasp on what the EU is by all the polling that has been done since. So uninformed people, the people most in favor were young people, people the age of this audience, 35% of them voted. Older people dressed more like the panel here, they essentially were all for Brexit, and they voted by close to 75%. So you have an uneven outcome. And then finally, you have essentially the fear of migrants coming into Europe, the fear sometimes of Eastern Europeans taking the jobs of British people. So you had the fear that this was that all Britain would unravel if this people were to move in, and you had, which is not really fully understood, parts of the Socialist Party, the Labour Party, were also actually for Brexit, because they have regarded that the whole notion of building socialism is no longer possible if you are an EU country member, with its commitment to capitalism, free markets, and all the above. So a number of those things mixed together made Brexit a possibility. The key thing to keep in mind as you go through this, it's utterly in the interest of the European Union to make life miserable for the British. If it ever looked like it was a good way to leave the European Union, what would happen? Other countries might leave as well. So there, that's the current tension. Will they figure it out of the way? Well, yes, of course. All negotiations take place in the last 72 hours, so it's premature to say. But I think as well, there is still a hope that maybe they'll have another vote and people will have a better grasp. With that, I will turn it over to my colleague.
That was research professor John Francis. Speaking next is assistant political science professor Tobias Hoffman.
Thank you very much, John. I brought my own tissues because I weep when I think of the future of Europe. No, just kidding. I have a cold. In fact, if anything, I think I should be accused of being a Euro-optimist. I personally, and I think you should agree, the European Union is one big success story. I mean, as John mentioned, started out with only 6 member states. It only focused on cooperation in the areas of coal and steel. And now we have 28 member states, maybe 27 in the near future. It is the second biggest economy in the world and will remain with or without Britain. It is just so far and has evolved so far beyond what the founding fathers of the European Union could ever imagine, with the 4 freedoms that you mentioned, the freedom to move and work in any country in the European Union, the freedom for goods and services to freely flow through the European Union, and the ability to invest anywhere in the European Union. And in many ways, the European Union might even be more successful in terms of integration than the United States itself. For instance, you students, many of you might have been affected by discrimination against out-of-state students. You pay higher tuition fees, something that doesn't exist in the European Union. If you're from Finland, you will study in Italy for exactly the same price as an Italian student, and vice versa. And there are many other areas where the European Union has gone kind of beyond what the United States has achieved in terms of integration of its economy and so on. But my job was or is to supposedly outline some of the challenges for the European Union. And one of them, I think, is simply perception. That is, the European Union might have or had for many, many years this kind of constant move forwards towards deeper and further integration and might have come a little bit to a standstill. But the reason of that is probably just because it has been so successful. So it has already picked all the low-hanging fruit, and what remains, fiscal policy, social policy, and so on, is just very, very, very hard to agree on and to integrate and to create kind of one social or fiscal policy for all of Europe. But yeah, specifically, what's kind of on the horizon? What are kind of 3 issues that I see? Well, of course, there's Brexit. And as you might have seen in the news, kind of a draft deal has just recently been announced. And I have to say, this deal is probably the best possible deal that the United Kingdom could expect. Because really, there is no good deal, or there's no deal that would make the United Kingdom in any way, shape, or form better off than what it is currently having as a member of the European Union. Only for real hardcore Brexiteers, those who don't care about the implications for the economy and the citizens, but that simply want independence, zero influence from Europe, those might be benefiting from or might perceive a hard Brexit to be the better option. But if you want any kind of deal, any kind of cooperation with Europe, the current deal, which is essentially similar to the one that Norway has, at least for the next 1.5 years to kind of buy some time for further negotiation, that is essentially for the United Kingdom to stick to all the rules of the European Union, reap most of the benefits of the European Union, but without having a say, not sitting at the negotiation table, that really is the best thing the United Kingdom could possibly expect. So I'm happy to go into kind of more details with respect to kind of some alternatives that have been floated, kind of some wishful thinking on the side of Brexiteers about how free trade deals with the European Union and some other countries could make the United Kingdom better off. But all of this is a big illusion, and there's just no way of getting anything from an economic perspective or so better than being a member of the European Union. For the rest of the European Union, yes, the UK will be a loss, but on the other hand, it might indeed be a blessing in disguise. The United Kingdom has for a long time been kind of the stumbling block, the country that has kind of hit the brakes whenever the other European Union member states wanted to proceed with further integration. Without the UK, some of the projects that have been floated in the past, or maybe just a recent one about an integrated European military, might be easier to achieve. That's not to say that countries like Germany might not sometimes regret not having the United Kingdom in the European Union when it comes to fiscal issues, where the UK has traditionally had a kind of more fiscally conservative stance similar to Scandinavian country and Germany. But overall, France and Germany will be strengthened, and those two have been the drivers of European integration. Okay, what else? I said I had three issues. I think the probably more urgent and potentially even more disastrous situation is the budget situation in Italy. Again, you might have seen something about this in the news, about this budget fight between the current Italian government and the European Commission. It essentially boils down to the current government having too optimistic a view on the potential growth in Italy, and simply is willing to spend too much and to borrow too much, at least kind of based on criteria set by the European Union for Eurozone member states. Overall, again, the media kind of tends to paint a very bleak picture, pointing out, for instance, that Italy's borrowing costs have dramatically increased over the last couple of weeks, that it is currently paying way more for its government debt than, for instance, Germany. However, again, let's put that into kind of a broader perspective. What was Italy's borrowing costs or work borrowing costs prior to joining the Eurozone? They were dramatically higher. So while the situation might not be great, it is not really all that bad in comparison to situations in Italy in the past prior to the introduction of the euro. That said, again, should Italy truly get into trouble with respect to its ability to repay or service its debt, then there is this real issue, because Italy is kind of too big to fail and too big to bail out. Which other country kind of was prominently bailed out in recent years? Greece. Well, Greece is only about 1/10 of the size in terms of the economy than Italy. So even for Germany, France, and so on, it would be very, very expensive and very, very hard to convince its domestic voters to be willing to transfer large amounts of money just to kind of bail out Italy. Finally, I was asked to talk a little bit about the European parliamentary elections that are coming up next year. Again, why is this maybe a challenge? Because traditionally, the European Parliament has been perceived as one of the drivers of European integration, an institution that simply inherently is very much pro-Europe, because, well, where do these members of the European Parliament get their salary from? From Europe. So it's kind of a vested interest in a successful European integration project. However, given the electoral system for the European Parliament proportional representation, smaller parties, including kind of anti-European parties, tend to do fairly well in European parliamentary elections, and the perceived risk might be that the European Parliament turns into a parliament of Eurosceptics. Personally, I think this is very unlikely, so even though they might do better than they do in national elections, overall in those national elections, we've seen that kind of these right-wing parties tend to perform somewhere between 10 and 20% in most European Union member states on policies that, well, gain almost a majority in the United States with respect to immigration and so on. So personally, I'm not so scared because I think the center is just big enough and there's not enough kind of polarization between the center left and the center right for them not to continue the job that they have kind of successfully done in the future. Kind of one thing, I guess for use of time, I will not address this right now, but one kind of aspect of these European parliamentary elections that might be interesting and relevant is what implications it has for who will be the next president of the European Commission, so essentially the CEO of the administrative branch of the European Union. Because in the last or after the last election, kind of the winner of the European parliamentary election was or became the president of the European Commission, as it would traditionally be done in kind of parliamentary systems with prime ministers. But there is no kind of firm rule that requires that to be the case. And it is not clear exactly how it will kind of play out next year. And it could create issues between member states that cannot agree on who should be this president of the Commission. And it could lead to a fight between the member states and the European Parliament should the member states not kind of follow the precedent set after the last European parliamentary election, where Jean-Claude Juncker was kind of the top candidate of the biggest party that won the most votes in the European parliamentary elections. But again, there is no firm rules that would require that to be the case after the next European Parliament elections. It's kind of interesting, or it will be interesting to see how exactly that plays out. Thank you, Audrey.
That was political science professor Tobias Hoffman of the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. Today we are re-airing a forum on the European Union, the UK's expected departure from the EU, and other problems the EU member states face across the continent. We return to Associate Professor Marjorie Castle of the Political Science Department of the University of Utah.
Thanks. If I understood correctly, my topic is going to be much narrower. I was asked to concentrate on Eurosceptic parties in the Eastern member states. And given the stances that both Hungary and Poland are taking towards the EU, given those conflicts, this is an important topic. And it's a new kind of development. EU members in open conflict with the EU over fundamental constitutional principles. What's happening in Hungary and with Hungary and Poland disrupts the EU in a different way from how Brexit is shaking it up, but in very important ways. Now, the parties currently governing Hungary and Poland are also extremely interesting because they appear to fall into a category of parties that is disrupting politics as usual in Europe and across the world as well. Populist parties, and particularly parties that are populist and right-wing and even nationalist. In my remarks, I want to clarify what is similar to phenomena elsewhere and what is distinct about the populist Eurosceptic leaderships of Hungary and Poland, because this helps us understand what their impacts may be. So now, when we're talking about Euroscepticism in the Eastern member states, in former communist-ruled countries that used to be part of the Soviet bloc, it's important to distinguish between two things. One, what we might call a soft or even classic Euroscepticism. Parties and politicians reflecting and articulating citizens' doubts about the impact of EU policies on their economies and their lives. And on the other hand, what we might call a hard Euroscepticism. And I believe that this is what we are seeing in Hungary and Poland right now. Parties in government that are rejecting EU rulings and limitations on actions that those governments want to take about the shape of their political arena, about their political institutions. that latter, that hard Euroscepticism, is something relatively new, and we won't understand its causes or be able to predict its implications if we don't realize the way in which it is different. Now, so let me explain what public Euroscepticism in the Eastern member states looks like. It takes the form of this soft Euroscepticism. And to understand it, there are two angles we need to understand: the performance question, and the traditional values question. But neither of them should be viewed as deterministic, as determining the strength of Euroscepticism. First, the performance question. It's a matter of high expectations for what the European Union will provide, and relatively low delivery given the height of those expectations. Research suggests that a utilitarian model based on output legitimacy, that is, how does the EU perform for me, that this still tends to play a larger role in determining EU support in the Eastern member states than in the Western member states. Adherence to a European identity is less important in the Eastern member states than perceptions of how the EU is delivering for me and people like me. Now, on the other hand, EU performance for the Eastern member states has been relatively good. But even with this relatively good performance, even with their economies doing well, there's quite a range of success across this region. And in the country that is now in the most conflict with the EU, Poland, perhaps has been doing the best economically. But the crucial thing is to remember is there are plenty of people not doing well. Older and retired people in general, but youth as well, especially the less educated and those living in rural areas. So there are plenty of people who look at EU performance for them and have to give it a low grade. And everyone, even those who are doing relatively well in the Eastern member states, can look at the contrast between their countries and the Western member states and find reason for dissatisfaction. Another angle here, when we look at the performance question, is scapegoating by governments. Political elites using the blame the EU narrative for policy failures, even in policy areas that don't involve the EU. So the key thing to remember is there is a potential basis for Euroscepticism based on economic and performance in other policy areas. But there's also a potential basis for Euroenthusiasm in most of the same areas. Which will dominate depends to a large extent on interpretation by political elites and the media in these countries. There is another angle to this soft Euroscepticism among the public in the Eastern member states. The values that dominate in the Western members of the European Union are seen as threatening to the traditional values of many, not all, but many in the Eastern member states. This is a factor that is again subject to interpretation by political elites. Enthusiastic participation in the EU could be seen as an opportunity to redefine what Europe is, to make Europe more of a repository of traditional Christian values. So even this angle doesn't have to add up to Euroscepticism. Now, that is all public Euroscepticism, soft Euroscepticism. There are soft Eurosceptic parties in the Eastern member states. There are parties that base their Euroscepticism on similar concerns. But what I want to point out, what I want to argue, is that the Euroscepticism of the current leaderships of Hungary and of Poland is qualitatively different. Okay, so here I'm talking about Fidesz in Hungary and Law and Justice in Poland. And I need to be specific about this, because this is a matter, what we're seeing here is a matter of choices by political elites. So you have to look at the actual actors. And it is important to be aware of ways in which these parties differ from other populist parties, even in Europe, say Alternative for Germany, or the Five Star Movement, or the Sweden Democrats. Fidesz in Hungary and Law and Justice in Poland are longstanding parties, at least as far as the current democracy in these countries. They've been around for quite a relatively long time. And they were never Eurosceptic in the past. So this takes us to the question of what is this hard Euroscepticism that we are seeing from these parties, why it has come to the kind of conflict where I saw a recent commentary in the Irish Times that was arguing that what is happening with Hungary and Poland and the EU is a greater challenge to the EU than Brexit. So what is this hard Euroscepticism of these two parties? The primary component is that the political actions taken by these parties and that these parties want to take in order to consolidate their power domestically runs afoul of EU rules and EU values. For domestic reasons, for internal power calculations, and I'll keep this short, that's a fascinating topic, these countries are coming into direct conflict with the standards and requirements of the European Union. Thus, and for other reasons, they have turned to making use, well, thus they have turned populist. And thus they turn to to the softer Euroscepticism, which gives them justification for defying the EU, justifying this to their societies. But the nature of this challenge they're mounting to the EU comes from this direct confrontation between these political forces that need to erode democratic protections in their societies in order to hold on to and maintain and strengthen their power and the limitations of the EU. A broader question this suggests is whether populism itself is inherently Eurosceptic, since these parties and other populist parties need a them to blame. The European Union certainly lends itself well to such an interpretation. And in general, we may see that the growth of populist parties of this nature is going to increase the tensions and pressure on the European Union.
That was Associate Professor Marjorie Castle of the Political Science Department of the University of Utah. Up next is political science professor Brent Steele.
Okay, and then I think I'm bringing up the rear here when it comes to broadening this out even more, because I'm somebody that studies international relations, especially from an historical perspective, so I don't really have a lot specifically regarding the EU, other than broadening out some of these factors, international or global factors, that I think are important for understanding, especially the EU over the last 10 to 15 years, but in ways that also might draw some connections with, for instance, what's happening in the United States over the last few years or even decade. So I wanted to just call attention to three broader global contexts or processes or atmospherics that I think are important to consider. So I guess we've all identified ourselves as either Euro, what did you call yourself, an optimist? Or Euroskeptics. I guess I'm a Eurorealist, to try to split the middle. Because I think we need to recognize some of these broader contexts so that we can have a real on, and some of them have already been brought up very effectively, much more effectively than I'm going to be able to, so that we can actually have an honest appraisal of where the EU is and why the future isn't necessarily going to resolve the present, and the past and the nostalgic sort of fantasies of the past are not necessarily going to resolve some of the issues of the EU either. So what are these three broader global contexts or processes? Well, one is really atmospheric, and that's sort of our era of late modernity. What I mean by that is simply that we're in an era where all the things that were supposed to improve our lives, so whether we were promised jetpacks or not, we haven't gotten them yet, but all the things that were supposed to improve our lives, that we're told are supposed to improve our lives, like routines or expertise or expert advice or technology or specialized training, a lot of those things have actually only made us more anxious and more afraid and more frustrated and more distrustful. So the outcome has been a turning away from and even a disdain for elites or any kind of expertise that we find nationally, locally, or internationally. And one thing that we have seen in surveys, not just here in the United States, but everywhere, and especially in Europe and in Britain, especially in leading up to the Brexit vote, was a distrust in lots of institutions. And in fact, in the United States, the only institution that maintains any trust anymore is the military. And that's good in some respects, but it might also be problematic in others if we don't have other institutions that individuals can trust. So the EU, as an institution that sometimes gets the tag of being an elitist institution, especially by these populist politicians, appears to be a casualty of this. So there's this broader sense in late modernity that there are all these things that are supposed to improve our lives, and if not necessarily make us happier, make us more secure, and it doesn't feel that way, it actually feels like it's the opposite. We've never been more anxious than we are now. So that's one process or context. A second one, which has already been brought up a little bit, is economic insecurity. So economic inequality was brought up by both Professor Castle and Professor Francis. But what I'm talking about here is a broader, in certain areas, especially in the West, a broader hollowing out of the middle classes. Now, this is something that accelerated following the global financial crisis. But it's led to a genuine sense that many, and Professor Castle mentioned this, are left out of the global capitalist project. There are many that are doing really well right now, but there are some that are not. Professor Stiglitz, Joseph Stiglitz, gave a lecture here, some of you may have gone to it, about 3 weeks ago, where he was talking about all of the different little pockets and areas within the United States, Europe, and the UK, where there are folks that are feeling left behind. And even at a physical level, this is having impact in terms of a decrease in the life expectancy of certain groups, especially white males in the United States are seeing this. He calls these deaths of despair. And these are the same groups that feel like they're being left out of the global capitalist project as we see it today. That left behind feeling has led to two outcomes, both of which I think are having effects in terms of some of the instability surrounding the EU. One is a frenzied or insecure busyness that prevents many people from effectively participating in politics. So Professor Francis mentioned not necessarily just who participated in the Brexit vote, but who did not. I think a lot of that is just because so many people, and we forget about this, all of us in an institute of politics here, that a lot of people just don't have time for politics because they're out trying to work a bunch of different jobs, trying to take care of their kids, trying to take care of their health, often unsuccessfully in all of those different realms. And so because of that, a broader sense of a lack of control over our own economic destinies is leading us to withdraw from politics. But secondly, it's also leading to a scapegoating, and this is a little bit of a different kind of scapegoating than the kind of scapegoating that Professor Castle talked about, and that's a scapegoating, especially after crises, of marginalized groups. So instead of calling the system or the particular institution of capitalist economies into question, we marginalize the groups that we think are the ones that are bringing the whole system down to begin with. So in the United States, following the global financial crisis, it was the poor, migrants, minorities, and a new group sort of emerged as being responsible, and that was public sector workers. In the EU, there was something that was happening after the global financial crisis, and especially in the Eurozone crisis, and that was that the southern countries were the ones that were responsible for bringing down the EU. And some of this scapegoating was happening by central players within the EU, especially of the so-called PIGS countries. And that was the acronym, and it's a horrible acronym, but of Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain. And so there was this understanding that was developed, a narrative that was often misplaced when you looked at the data, that there were the hardworking Europeans that were keeping the EU going forward, the Germans, hint, hint, wink, wink, and then the ones that were not, the lazy, shiftless folks that had huge deficits in Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain. And there's also a little bit of a racialized element there as well. But what that resulted in, all of that, is that a larger sort of scapegoating of that sort of papers over some of the real issues that the EU has as both an economic and a political community that I think were not properly confronted. And then a third context, and I'll just mention this just briefly, is just a crisis over democratic representation. Ever since Maastricht, at the very least, there has been this broader concern over the EU's democratic deficit, and this was discussed by my colleagues earlier, that those that are being impacted by the EU and are voting, are participating in the elections regarding the EU, are so distant from the EU that their concerns are not properly being represented by the EU and by the Parliament. So this is part of a broader, I think, global concern that those that are in charge of representing us are not adequately doing so. And so this is something that's not just connected to the EU, but maybe some other democratic communities as well. And this has resulted in a cynicism regarding politics generally and a decreasing level of civic trust. And then you see this in moves to reassert some more local, immediate control over our democratic representation. And I think this is another factor that was behind the Brexit vote as well. So where to go with this? I think that if you take all three of these contexts together, I think it leads to a couple broader tendencies. One is a turning back to earlier traditions or eras or institutions in modernity. And some of those are the state or sovereignty or control over our borders or control over our economic systems. And so a reassertion of control over borders is something that maybe makes us feel like we can have control in an era where it seems like things are slipping away from our control every day. But then there's also a nostalgia for a past that feels like it was simpler and a little bit easier to manage than the present. And so there is this nostalgia, and I think it is a sort of fantastical nostalgia that I think we can all empathize with, that also has some really problematic effects because it papers over some of the historical contexts and backgrounds that have led to the developments of where we are today. So what are some suggestions for handling this? I just have two. One is to recognize that the EU has real issues. So this is what I mean by being a Euro realist. It has some real issues and that it hasn't effectively confronted, and then it can't moralize its way out of. And I'm speaking as if it's a totality, and it's not. I know it's not. But some of the narratives try to moralize the EU away from some of the problems. It's not because the Greeks or the Italians are lazy, and that's why the EU doesn't function as effectively as it has, or it could. That's not the reason. There are some real issues there that need to be confronted. There are winners and losers that come with any sort of move towards integration, and we need to confront that effectively and honestly. But a second suggestion is also something that I think those of us in higher education, there's a role that we can play here. And that is speaking to the history that gets invoked as if it's going to be a better sort of answer for replacing the present with some kind of a past, and talking about that history directly. One of the other things that's happening all throughout, especially certain parts of Central and Eastern Europe, that's a background condition to some of these populist parties that Professor Castle was talking about, was a forgetting of the history behind why the EU was sort of an answer or a possibility after World War II, and that is World War II itself. And not just World War II in terms of national armies going after one another, but what some of these actors in World War II did to marginalized groups. So the former Yugoslavia had a lot of monuments and memorials that were dedicated to remembering and memorializing the Holocaust. A lot of those are coming down now that the former Yugoslavia no longer exists. And they're enabling a sort of nationalist and to some degree anti-Semitic sets of processes that are really problematic. And so I think there's a role to play for those of us that are in higher education and a broader appreciation in our broader political communities for what universities can do. It's not just about producing STEM degrees. That's important, but that's not the only thing. If we see this rise in xenophobia and racism and anti-Semitism that we think is problematic, and you want to do something about it, then figure out ways to empower those of us that can speak to the broader historical context that are there so that they don't get whitewashed. And if that's the case, and the future's not going to solve all of this because of technological developments, and the past isn't going to resolve this because the past isn't necessarily, the good old days weren't always good, then that means that we have to confront the present. And that's a much more honest place to be, and that has implications for the EU and our broader international community. Thanks.
That's political science professor Brent Steele speaking at the Hinckley Institute on November 19th, 2018. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. If you're just joining us, today we re-air a forum on the future of the European Union. In this final segment, the panel takes questions from the audience.
So all of you have talked about Brexit and the implications on the EU there. And earlier it was mentioned that it's important for the European Union to show Brexit and Great Britain's exit from the EU as somewhat of a failure. I just want to know, in your opinion, has that been the case? Has it been a failure for Great Britain in leaving the EU? Has it been kind of more of a mixed bag? Has it been a good thing for Britain? What are your thoughts?
So Britain is still in the EU as we speak. And what they're negotiating now are the terms on which it leaves. And has it been helpful over the years? If your larger question is, has Britain gained from the EU? I would say, yes, it has. If you looked at the British economy in the 1970s, it was at best a make-do economy. The standard of living was declining, it was weak, and for maybe a number of different reasons, it's much stronger today than it was then. But it's also the case that the economy has changed. Manufacturing has steadily retreated in Britain. Services have gone up. There's a lot of resentment in Britain about London, and London is ever wealthy, but it makes its money off of financial services and lots of Russian oligarchs bringing in cash. I don't know. So in any event, I think it actually probably has helped, but it has changed Britain in dramatic ways that I think are important to stress. And I'd mention one other point. Any British politician running for parliament will run against Brussels, the way that many politicians in our region of the country will run against Washington. Partly because it's easier to do that, and you can score points. And so in a way, they've kind of contributed to this criticism of the EU. I accept Brent's comment that the EU is less than perfect, but it's also the case that the way it's set up makes it easy to score points against it, not all of them deserved.
So on the topic of Poland and Hungary, we've seen these countries go further in the direction of, you know, getting rid of judges and elections. I'm just curious if you think, you know, this kind of sometimes called illiberalism, if it'll spread to other countries in Europe, or, you know, how much it'll continue in these countries to get worse, or if it'll, you know, the pendulum will go in the other direction.
I suspect it may spread. It's a potential. It's a political tool. It's been shown, Poland and Hungary have shown that it works. That this is a way of solidifying power, and that the potential voting support is there, that it works strategically. So I would expect it to spread. Unfortunately.
So I just had a quick follow-up to that. I mean, one of the other things that's a casualty of that, and in the bigger sort of context, this isn't necessarily as urgent, but you have seen a clamping down of the university systems in some of these countries as well. I mean, the Central European University, which I'm sure you've heard of, has been shut down, right? And who was a major supporter of Central European University? George Soros, right? And so some of these broader factors and sort of problematic outcomes of what we were seeing in terms of the tensions that are there and the rising levels of I mean, let's just call it anti-Semitism and anti-intellectualism are having a real effect. I mean, some of us know folks that were at Central European University in Budapest that are being relocated. That's problematic, but it's also an indication that those universities were serving a particular purpose that was at odds with this move towards a liberalism. And that's something that I don't think we can ignore either. The moves towards that, the moves towards control over that, and then what necessarily to do about it as folks that are in higher education and folks that, in my case, I don't view this as just a job, but as a vocation as well.
Thanks. Such a stimulating panel. It was really great. My question is quite gruesome, and it's little mentioned. One possible future for the EU and its 500 million people is obliteration. There are about 200 hydrogen bombs stationed in Germany, and of course France has them, England has US hydrogen bombs. My question is, do you know if there's a unified command and control of these weapons in the EU, unified at the EU level? And the second part is, why does the EU let itself be subservient to U.S. military policy in terms of NATO?
So I'm not 100% sure if there's 100% control and command of the nuclear weapons, but there has been, when it comes to integration and disintegration, the control over nuclear weapons and power is something that is usually on the in the forefront of some of the considerations. So even before the Brexit vote, there was a really important vote in Britain, and that was the vote for Scottish independence. And one of the issues that was discussed was if the Scots were able to vote for independence, what would happen to the nuclear, especially I think it was the nuclear subs, that were going to be within Scottish national waters. And to some degree, a lot of these countries don't want control over nuclear weapons because it's costly and it can be a security risk. So I think if we did see at least the disintegration of the EU, this is a little bit of a counterfactual here, my sense is that it would be a little bit like the disintegration of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, where transfer of control of those nuclear weapons would be sort of, I think, and any of my colleagues could correct me if I'm wrong here, sort of up to the great powers to figure out, just like the Nunn-Lugar bill in the early 1990s sort of helped coordinate and provide incentive structures to between the United States and then Russia to figure out how to be able to safely transfer that nuclear technology and those nuclear weapons. But it is a conundrum that I think is important, especially if we're talking about the transfer to an independent European military force or collective security organization that's separate from NATO. Your second question was regarding sort of the leverage between the EU and the United States. Right. I mean, this is something that I think, it's weird, it's strange bedfellows, but I think that that's something that even some of the nationalists, which are on both the left and the right here in the United States, want reconsidered. I think President Trump's concerns regarding how much the United States provides in terms of NATO spending is something that is part of a broader concern that the United States is spending so much for other countries' security guarantees and not necessarily getting as much out of it. It's a delicate line, right? There are historical reasons and identity reasons for that relationship and that arrangement between the United States being highly involved in European security and what Europe provides then in terms of stability or guarantees for the United States that I think would take a little bit of unraveling, no matter what's happening right now, it's going to be something that they're probably going to have to consider over a series of considerations in the future. But I'm not 100% sure why Europe is sort of insistent on that, other than the fact that, you know, it has benefited from the security umbrella that the United States has sort of provided in the form of NATO for a number of years. And there are some neoconservatives in the United States that look at this as sort of a paradise versus power situation. Europe's been able to develop this integrated community because it hasn't had to worry as much about its own physical military security, because the United States has been able to provide that. That's one argument. I'm not necessarily saying where I weighed in on that at all.
Okay. My question revolves around the demographic shifts. So you see the mostly Muslim but then African populations are coming into Europe. And obviously, the European Union countries, their birth rate is below replacement. So, you know, a couple of decades from now, you could see majority Muslim populations in some of these countries. How do you think that's going to affect the future of the EU?
I can say, I think it's an excellent question about how that works. And I'll give a British example. Where you find, when you break down the British population by county, you discover those areas where there are the fewest Muslims living have the greatest fear, if that makes sense. In other words, if you have people in your neighborhood who've lived there and their grandparents have lived there since the 50s, then they're part of your life, and you never think of them as someone coming from someplace else, if that follows. So, but their overall fear of something that could get out of control, if you ask any European country, how many people, what percentage of our population is Muslim, you'll often get numbers like 25%, when in fact, it's often around 5 or 6%, or in France, maybe 9 or 10%. So the fear is very much there, and there hasn't been as much thought on how you address it. In France, no data are allowed to be kept on the domestic population's religious identity. So we don't know in France how many people are Muslims. We only know the number of people born elsewhere. So the Europeans struggle to figure out how you integrate people. And I'm not saying that we do it well. That's not my claim. I simply say that is something they're not really addressing.
The only thing I would follow up with that is I actually think historically the United States has done it pretty well, has figured out a way to integrate at a level where everyone feels like they're invested in these institutions that are there to provide some sorts of outlets when it comes to economic and political participation, very imperfectly and historically during particular times, not well at all. But I think that is a challenge that the EU and the European countries that are members of the EU really do have to focus on. And in my view, it's the answer to it is figuring out ways to strengthen these institutions so that they can confront that the ability to integrate folks into their communities, rather than figuring out ways to you know, allow those institutions to be weakened. So that would be my suggestion.
That's political science professor Brent Steele speaking at the Hinckley Institute on November 19th, 2018. If you'd like to hear the full discussion, or if you missed some of the program, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour podcast. This program is made in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. Thanks for listening.